going. All right. This evening's call. Actually, let me put it on the conference line here. The conference. Bob, can you hear me?
I sure can.
All right, excellent. All right, this evening's speaker is Bob Sebahar, and he is one of the first board-certified specialists in sports dietetics in the United States. He is a former director of the sports nutrition for the University of Florida, and most recently served as sports dietitian for the U.S. Olympic Committee in Colorado Springs. Bob traveled to the 2008 Summer Olympics in Beijing, China, as a sports dietitian for the U.S. Olympic team and a personal sports dietitian for the Olympic triathlon team. As a nutrition coach, Bob specializes in enhancing health and improving performance through the use and the concept of nutritional periodization, which provides varied nutrition recommendations to each specific athlete based on training cycle, changes in body composition, and weight goals. He's also the author of the book, Nutrition Periodization for Endurance Athletes, Taking Sports Nutrition to the Next Level. And with that, I welcome Bob Sebahar to the call. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks, Kerry, for having me here and offering this great triathlon summit to everybody.
Oh, no problem, no problem. Let's get into our first question this evening. And like I said before, you've got the book on nutritional periodization. So why don't you explain to everyone what nutritional periodization is and how you came up with it?
Perfect. So the story dates back probably about 6 to 7 years when I remember it vividly, where I had the same Ironman triathlete come visit me about 2 to 3 years in a row with the same goal. So the first year he came to see me, he wanted to lose weight, lose some body fat to improve his time to try and qualify for Kona. So we got him down to his race weight, his fighting weight, qualified for Kona, and came back to me the next year about the same time with the same exact goal of losing weight. So I had kind of a puzzled look on my face, and I asked him, well, you know, didn't we do this last year? And he said, yeah, but I gained weight over the off season. So we went through the process again, and the third time around I realized that this athlete and all endurance athletes at that time were simply not thinking about their nutrition like they were their training, and that they weren't periodizing or separating their nutrition to actually support their physical training cycles. And that's kind of the basis of nutritional periodization, is that it supports whatever physical training that you are impairing on your body, whether or not you're coached or self-coached, whatever your physical goals, nutrition periodization should support those. How it works is very simple. Whenever there's, you know, the first question I usually get asked by athletes is, you know, Bob, what should I eat? And really the first question to ask yourself is what training cycle I'm in. That's the first and foremost, because you can't feed yourself appropriately if you don't know what you're trying to do to your body, be it increase strength, increase endurance, you know, take a fun, a planned recovery or whatnot.
Excellent. All right. And what can a triathlete gain from using nutritional periodization?
Yeah, you know, in the past, I've been in the field for 16 years now, and you know, the kind of the old school thinking is just looking at all the nutrients as one, and as carbohydrates, as protein and fat and water and micronutrients. But really, what athletes can gain, and specifically triathletes, is the number one and two goals of nutrition periodization that I've identified are pretty simple. We can enhance our health by keeping our immune system healthy, while really keeping enough energy in our system so we're able to train and not bonk. The second thing is we want to improve performance, so we actually we fuel our bodies and we hydrate our bodies well enough so we prepare our bodies for our workouts or for our training sessions, and I call that, I've got a mantra that I call eat to train, don't train to eat. And then third and foremost, the most important part of nutrition periodization, what triathletes can gain, is body composition and or body weight maintenance or manipulation. And now in the practice that I've been in years, you know, working with Olympic athletes and age group athletes, probably the number one goal athletes come to see me for is to reduce body weight and to reduce body fat. That is where nutrition periodization earns its keep, because, again, it's the cycling of your nutrition to support your training that can offer that body composition change or their body weight change. For example, just to give a short example, usually when you have high and low volume and intensity in your training, your nutrition will typically stay the same. Now, you may be able to get by with that if you have high training where you're burning a lot of calories and you may not be feeding yourself enough calories, but once you dip down either into an off-season, a recovery, a restoration block, or possibly even an injury state, if you maintain the same amount of nutrition and nutrient intake that you do normally, you're going to gain weight. So first and foremost, the main emphasis for nutrition periodization is controlling weight, controlling body composition.
Okay, excellent. And now, in terms of racing, a lot of people have issues in terms of stomach things going on, you know, upset stomachs or whatever. And so, really, what should be eaten before a race, during it, and after it?
Yeah. That's a great question, and again, I think one that many coaches get and one that I get quite often. And, you know, I hate to use this answer, it depends, but there are some factors before I answer this question that we have to kind of address first. And the first one is, has the athlete practiced in training what they're going to do on race day? And I know that may sound silly, but, you know, it's like buying a new pair of shoes the day before a race and trying them out on the race if you've never tried them before. But what I try and have athletes do is just like you have your separated cycles of training, be it preparatory or your base cycle, your intensity, your pre-competition, your race season, your off-season, what I like them to do is separate the sports, the swim, bike, and run, find what foods work well before each sport. So before you hop in the pool, you know, does a glass of juice and a banana work for you, or does a bowl of oatmeal, and can you do the same thing before a bike, and can you do the same thing before a run? Once you get to know, and I call this simply training the gut, once you train the gut, you can then move into your intensity training where you usually have a little more race simulation. So you're doing some combo workouts, you're doing some brick workouts. Then you can start trying this nutrition before these higher intensity, more demanding training sessions. And then maybe even, you know, if you have group workouts, you can kind of simulate a little stressful response of a race pattern to see if the body responds. But most importantly, think about the intensity of your exercise and the response of digestion. And this is why a lot of athletes have GI problems, gastrointestinal problems, because they don't realize that as intensity goes up, the blood flow in the gut actually becomes shunted or is delivered away from the gut, away from the stomach, to the working muscles to fuel exercise. Add on top of that the stress and the stress hormones that we get when we toe the line before we start, and the gut is constantly in distress. So what I recommend before a race, obviously, if you've done your homework and you've seen what works well for you in training and at high-intensity training, usually that will get you through before race day. Now, what I usually recommend athletes do is separate their race distances. So sprint, fueling for a sprint in an Olympic distance triathlon is going to be a lot different than fueling for a 70.3 and a full Ironman. So if we're doing the short course, which we can define as sprint and Olympic, what I usually like to say is because intensity is a little bit higher for that and the race is a little bit shorter, you could get by with the foods or the meals or the drinks that you've done in training during your high-intensity training. Typically, athletes, and this doesn't hold true for all, but typically athletes do better on what I call a semi-solid or a liquid meal beforehand because it gets out of the gut a little bit quicker. It's a little bit easier to digest when the stress hormones are increasing. And certainly what I recommend is usually between about 2 to 4 hours before a race, if you can afford it. And I know, you know, the race gun goes off sometimes at, you know, 7 a.m. and we're in the transition area by 5:30. But if you can afford it, wake up at least a couple hours before and put something back in your tank. And that's for a sprint and Olympic. For long course, you know, depending on how you've trained the gut during the season, if you've trained the gut to get by with less, you certainly don't want to put more in your stomach and more in your gut the morning of the race just because your friend or your training buddy tells you, hey, you're doing an Ironman or you're doing a 70.3, maybe you should eat a little bit more. You know, you really want to stay tried and true to the plan that you've done during training. But again, what holds true is still that you consume your meal or your snack 2 to 4 hours beforehand. Again, probably focusing a little bit more on semi-solids and liquids However, I'm a big fan of including a little bit more balance of nutrients, specifically carbohydrate and protein, to sustain the hunger response and really to not get that high blood sugar and insulin spike right before you toe the line.
Okay,
so that
great.
Was before the race.
Oh, sorry, keep going. Sorry, man, I thought you were
Okay. So that was before the race. During the race, again, you know, for the athletes on the line listening, really separate your race into the race distance, and more importantly, what would your intensity be? Because we know, you know, if you're an age grouper just having a great time out there at Ironman, then you can probably eat a little bit better, meaning you're not going to have as much blood flow shunted to your muscles. So you're going to be able to digest a little bit more food, possibly if you tried it in training. And there's this thing out there that, you know, athletes try and train their gut to consume more calories, and I'll get to that later in the talk. But what I really recommend athletes focus on during a race are consuming fluids, electrolytes, specifically sodium, carbohydrates, and, you know, if protein works for you, I never negate that from an athlete's during race nutrition plan. If it works for you, go ahead. I would just recommend more what I call single amino acids, in that those are branched chain amino acids and possibly glutamine, rather than the whole protein such as soy and whey protein, just because they're a little bit easier to digest at those higher intensities. So I'm not a big fan of recommending protein for everyone during a race, but if you've used it in training, it works for your gut, and you've had no problems, then stick with it.
Cool. You know, and what about after?
Yeah, after a race, you really have to, you know, a lot of this factors into the body composition goals. If you're just really wanting to focus on, boy, I just want really good nutrition recovery, I want to regain my glycogen stores, I want to replenish my fluid stores, I'm at a comfortable weight or body comp, and I just want to get to my next race really dialed in and recover well, what I recommend is you focus on what I call the Fab Four, and that is carbohydrates, fluid, sodium, and protein. And I'll give some guidelines here, because carbohydrates, just to make sense of this, we're using a lot of carbohydrates, a lot of limited stores of carbohydrate while we race. So we want to make sure we replenish that. And those are probably the ones in the highest quantity that we want to put back in our body. What's usually recommended, I can base it on body weight, but usually most athletes in a quote-unquote normal body weight should consume about 200 to 400 calories from carbohydrate, or 50 to 100 grams. From a fluid perspective, this gets a little tricky, because I've known, depending on your sweat rate and where you're racing in the country, especially if it's down in the southeast or the southwest during the summertime, you can really lose a lot of fluid, especially when the humidity turns up. If your sweat rate is pretty high and you lose a lot of fluid, you're going to want to try and decrease the amount of fluid you lose during and beforehand by properly hydrating yourself before the race and during the race, because the whole goal after the race is to minimize the amount you need to drink. For example, you should drink about 24 ounces of fluid for every pound of body weight that you lose during a race. Now, I've met a lot of athletes over my years, and I've done sweat rate testing on myself and others, and have found that if you lose any more than about 2 pounds during a race, and I ask you to drink 2 24-ounce bottles of a fluid, you may buy into that. But once we get to about over 3 bottles or 4 bottles or 5 bottles or 6 bottles, you look at me like I'm crazy. So,
yeah.
Again, what we want to really focus on is minimizing dehydration by maximizing your hydration strategy before and afterwards. From a protein perspective, we don't need a lot of protein after a race. We need about 10 to 20 grams. About 40 to 80 calories, that's it. That's just a little bit in there. And then sodium, think of sodium like a sponge. It acts to help kind of soak up that fluid and help us retain the fluid. So you can set a range of sodium, and certainly the minimum that exists is 500 milligrams, but really just eat some salty food, salty pretzels. I see a lot of athletes having watermelon with salt on it after a race. So, you know, choose your strategy, but definitely include those Fab Four. While I'm on this, and I race a lot myself, and probably one of the worst things we could see at the finish line is pizza for our recovery. Pizza is a great food. I hate to say that, because I love pizza. It's one of my favorite foods. But right immediately after racing, and we want to start this nutrition within about 15 minutes – of finishing and crossing that finish line, after 15 minutes, after a couple hours, pizza does fine. Once you've gotten the Fab Four in there, you're rehydrated, you're getting that process started. But because of the high fat content with pizza, and you didn't hear me say that we need a lot of fat post-workout or post-race, so that fat content will actually work against carbohydrates in refilling your glycogen stores. So I don't recommend the pizza. You know, take a couple slices, wrap it up, have it a couple hours later.
All right, good deal. Good advice on that one for sure.
Yep.
All right. So do triathletes have different nutritional needs compared to other endurance sports or athletes?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think because we do three sports, you know, and sometimes if we want to throw in strength training as the fourth sport, it's because we do three sports, we have different needs from the standpoint of we need to find what foods work best for our gut. And I only say that because all of you out there listening, if you're triathletes, you know what may or may not work for you before you get in the water, before you get in that prone position where, you know, you could have a little bit of reflux because of that position. Then you get on the bike, and, you know, a lot of triathletes think the bike is all about a buffet because it's easy to eat. And then the run, our calories go down quite a bit. So I would say our needs are different in that we're doing three sports that have different body positions and different mechanics that are involved that interrupt digestion differently. So we're not pure runners, we're not pure cyclists, we're not pure swimmers. And in fact, we even know, you know, long course open water swimmers, you know, they can stop and they can ingest some stuff. It's tricky. But because we're combining the three, our needs are special in that we need to find what foods work best for our gut.
Excellent. All right.
Yep.
Good deal. And what's the biggest mistake you see triathletes make in their nutrition? And then basically, how can they fix that?
Yeah. I see there's kind of a two-prong approach. I'll talk about daily nutrition and then training or racing nutrition. So I think, you know, during the day, and this may sound like a no-brainer, but during the day I see a lot of triathletes make the mistake of not staying hydrated, not staying well-nourished, so they don't feed often, they don't snack often, and they go into the training sessions without a lot of gas in their tank or without a lot of carbohydrate in their tank. And if you have quality training sessions and you don't have a lot of gas in the tank, you're not going to be able to make the objectives and the goals, the physiological goals and the adaptations that you or your coach wants, because you're running on empty or you're running on low. So that, from a daily perspective, I see that as kind of a low-hanging fruit where it's just simply combining lean protein, healthy fat, fruits and veggies, whole grains, depending on your weight goals. Combining that at every feeding is the easiest way to fix that. Now I get to get on my soapbox a little bit and talk to you about training and racing. I think by far, excuse me, and I think this may shock many listeners out there, I think by far the biggest mistake triathletes make during training or during a race is over-consuming calories and under-consuming electrolytes. So let me support those statements, because it could be a shocker, especially the calories one, because especially if you do long course racing, a lot of athletes, a lot of coaches out there, a lot of the old school is saying, train your body, train your gut to eat and ingest as many calories as possible. The way I look at it is, if we can train your body to utilize more of its internal fat stores, of which we have almost unlimited, we've got probably 80,000, 100,000 and more calories stored as fat in our body, and protect our carbohydrate stores, of which we probably only have between about maybe 1,600 to 2,000 calories in our body, I would rather have an athlete try and train their bodies to use more fat at higher intensities, and this is a principle that I refer to as metabolic efficiency, instead of trying to shove more calories down in their gut while they're racing or training. Now think about this. Remember what I said before. As intensity of exercise goes up, if you're doing quality training sessions or if you're racing, as your intensity goes up, your body's ability to digest food goes down. So every opportunity you introduce a large amount of carbohydrates, of calories, of protein, whatever it is, the higher risk you have for GI distress. And I think I said this earlier, that the two main concerns athletes come to see me about are weight loss and body comp loss and GI distress, minimizing GI distress. So just remember, whenever you can try this, you know, go out to the track or do some swim intervals and try and eat as much as you can during your rest intervals.
No, I'm all set.
I will guarantee, yeah, I will guarantee you have GI distress. So the biggest mistake is saying, oh, you know, I, you know, kind of taking the new research that says we can absorb a lot of carbohydrates, but, it, you know, the mistake would be, wow, if the research says that and it's only been done on cyclists, take that for a little golden nugget. It's great research, and it gives us great information, but especially if you're more of a petite female or a smaller guy competing in triathlon, you try and push 90 grams or 360 calories in your body per hour, you're going to have some GI distress. So what I try and get athletes to do is kind of buy into the principle less is more. So train your body to utilize the fat stores, protect your carbohydrate stores, and only give your body what it needs instead of overfeeding. So that's my first point. my second point is on my electrolyte soapbox. Almost every single athlete I talk to regarding, and we can, you know, when I say electrolytes, I'm really talking, I'm a big fan of the whole electrolyte panel that we normally see, those being sodium, chloride, potassium, calcium, and magnesium. We know sodium chloride are the two big ones when it comes to cramping, but what I usually see is a lot of athletes, for whatever reason, they're underdosing their electrolyte intake. Therefore, they're getting hyponatremic, they're feeling dizzy, dehydrated, they're feeling lethargic. It's a very simple thing to fix because all you need to do is dose up on your electrolytes. And even if you follow, and I've got a lot of athletes who I consult with who follow what I call a clean diet. So not a lot of processed foods, not a lot of junk, not a lot of refined products. So they follow kind of a lower sodium diet, and they want to maintain that, and that's fine. Just remember, your body is so, so good at balancing its fluid and electrolytes, that if you introduce a high load of electrolytes, your body is going to send the signal to your brain to drink more water. Therefore, it's going to remain in balance. So I would rather overdose electrolytes during a race, especially if it's hot, especially if it's humid, rather than underdosing and, you know, relying on the ambulance to pick you up or DNFing or, you know, having to get some IVs in the arm.
All right. Actually, quick question on that.
Yeah.
Do you basically calculate how many calories a specific athlete needs, or how do you work that when they're racing?
Yeah, you can. Yep, that's a great question. It's hard. You know, there's some spreadsheets that are floating around the internet that I've seen, and you know, it takes into consideration your body weight. Body weight is only one factor of it. In fact, you don't know. You know, if you've got two athletes weighing 170 pounds. They're going to process calories differently. One may have an allergic response to certain foods or an intolerance. So what I like to look at is I always start an athlete on the lowest dosing possible for carbohydrates. So and that would be 30 grams an hour or 120 calories. I start there in training, and then I'll dose up as needed during their quality training sessions. And then by the end of their quality training block, then they know how much to consume in the race, if that makes sense.
Yeah. No, okay. It does. It does make sense, yeah.
Yep.
All right. And with that, you did – basically, the USA Triathlon team did a really good job in terms of staying healthy in the lead-up to the Beijing Olympics, and they all credit you in big part to that. So – what did you do to keep them healthy and going good? Because a lot of times, you know, people are training for that big race and they get sick at the last minute or they get injured or whatever. And I just like to know the strategies that you use to make that all work well for them.
Yeah, great question. I think can be applied to all of us who travel, even if it's not internationally. And you can pick up some golden nuggets from some of the tips I'm going to say now. But really, you know, when I was at the USOC, we obviously didn't treat the Olympics too lightly. We started planning for this, the food portion of the whole Olympics, about 18 months beforehand. And included in that, I'm not going to tell you the behind the scenes of actually sourcing the food, but I will tell you that I started educating the triathletes, and we didn't even know who was on the team yet, but 18 months beforehand, especially 12 months beforehand, I started educating them on nutrition periodization, so saying let's cycle your nutrition, let's work with your coach, make sure it's supporting your needs, your physical needs, but more importantly, let's start training your gut to identify what foods work best for you, what foods don't work good for you in hot and humid conditions, because that's what we knew that we would face in Beijing. So about 12 months out, we started to get pretty serious at developing what I call GI-safe food lists. And that's what I recommend to everyone is identify what foods you know of that you can put in your gut during high intensities, during different environmental conditions based on where you're going, that will not induce GI distress, that will be safe, that will be easy to digest no matter what the condition, no matter what the situation. From there, what we did was we were able to provide athletes these little hot pots, little rice cookers. If you can guys imagine a 32-ounce or a 1-quart plastic hot pot that's powered by an electrical source, we gave every single athlete a hot pot and a power transformer and held cooking classes for a lot of them that were in the area. So we showed them how to use it. I came up with menu ideas of what can you cook. It's kind of that one-pot cooking approach. What can you cook in one pot, be it rice, vegetables, oatmeal, you name it. So we really took into account the education of cooking, as well as going to the store and picking out certain foods that were right for them based on their GI safe list. So again, if we're traveling, and I do this myself when I travel to races, if they're in a different part of the country or different part of the world, I will bring my GI safe food list items with me. I'll bring my cooking source, because you can, even if you don't trust the water, boil it for 4 or 5 minutes and it should be pretty safe. It's doing all that in preparation for where you're going. So that was on the front end. On the back end, once we got there, now they of course had the luxury of having me, you know, full time, and that was one of my primary jobs, but I made sure that before we went, and I should back up, before the Olympics, they took me the year before, because they had a staging event in Beijing exactly like the Olympics, same course. We actually stayed at the same location in both locations that we stayed, so we knew what food sources we had available. We knew what cooking methods. We knew if it was safe. And, you know, the funny story is when we were in Beijing in 2007, I tried to get in the kitchen of the hotel we were staying in by the course, and it took me about 3 days to convince these people to allow me in the kitchen. We went through a lot of interpreters, a lot of management, but finally I went into the kitchen and I realized, and I kind of did my scouting then and my recon and saying, you know, this kitchen is unacceptable for what we need. Therefore, I controlled all of our nutrition. So through help with the USOC and through help with the athletes bringing their food and their hot pots, I cooked their meals. I made their lunches. I had them do most of their breakfast in their hot pots, because we brought a lot of oatmeal, and I prepared the dinners, not in the restaurant, but I depended on our U.S.-based cafeteria restaurant. So, again, kind of the golden nuggets are control everything you can. If you can do recon before your event, great. If not, scope it out on the Internet, find a grocery store, and really know what foods work good for your gut. Take an extra suitcase. I know it costs a little bit to check these things in now. Take an extra suitcase worth of food and cooking equipment, and that is the easiest way to be prepared. And you know, we eliminated in 2007 in our staging race, we had three athletes get sick. One actually ended up going to the hospital. And in 2008, Carrie, as you said, we had absolutely zero athletes with GI distress. We had no problems at all. And interestingly enough, to point this out, we stayed at a different hotel than all the other athletes did. We stayed at not the host hotel, but one that was about 4K away. And a lot of the athletes who ate at the host hotel had GI distress on race day. So there's something to be said with, if you can control everything on the front end and the back end, you're gonna almost, there's little things that can enter in there, but you're gonna almost keep your gut safe.
Yeah.
It was definitely fun. I remember you know, we had a lot of translators too, and going through, and you know, we were actually in South Korea 9 days before at our training camp, and I didn't have a translator there, but I had to somehow communicate with our Korean chef. And what I ended up doing was, because the language barrier is so great, I actually ended up going on the Internet, finding the foods just in, you know, Google Photos, Google Images, finding the photos of foods I put on the menu, put it in a PowerPoint presentation, and every morning I would show her our daily menu. And that was the easiest way to communicate with her.
Good deal. That's pretty cool.
Yep.
Cool. Bob, where can people get your book?
They can get it either at my website, fuelformance.com, F-E-U-L, the number 4, M-A-N-C-E.com, or just search for it on Amazon.
Okay, great. Okay, what's your take on supplements? Do you need them? Do you not need them? What's your opinion on that?
I got to tell you, next to nutrition periodization, this is probably the most evolving area of sport nutrition since I started this field 16 years ago. It's progressed from, we know a lot of strength and power athletes have used supplements, and it's just, I think a lot of endurance athletes, while they may not think about it, they use supplements almost every day. And if they're drinking sport drinks or consuming energy gels or energy bars, I think, the lowest denominator with that is just remember that all these bars that you're consuming and gels and drinks and chews and you name it, they do have some extra micronutrients, vitamins and minerals. So those can be considered a supplement depending on how you term that. I usually categorize supplements into dietary supplements. So those are like your calcium, your iron, your zinc, your B vitamins, your multivitamin. Then you can certainly do the ergogenic supplements. So those are the performance enhancing, and those would be, items specific to triathletes. Those would be things like carbohydrate, fluid. Yes, those are ergogenic. Sodium citrate is definitely up there. Some of the adaptogens, which I can talk about, are up there. And then the last one are just the sport supplements, like I said, the bars, the gels, the drinks. So I actually classify supplements into three categories. Once you can think about them in those three categories, it becomes very clear that we take supplements, we need supplements. It just depends on what classification you're talking about. Now, if I go through all of them, if I can have a few minutes just to discuss all of them, from a sports supplement, the energy bars, the gels, the drinks, the chews, absolutely hands down. Those are needed at only certain times of the year, but they're definitely needed to contribute to keeping us in a good calorie state, in a good fluid state, in a good electrolyte state. So those are the low hanging fruit. I think from a dietary perspective, your multivitamins, your B vitamins, your zinc, your iron, I am a huge proponent of some of those, specifically for endurance athletes, iron in particular, possibly vitamin B12 if you're a vegan or a vegetarian athlete, don't eat any animal products. And certainly calcium sometimes for females. So I think there's a lot of good when it comes to a dietary supplement. I think the most work I do and continue to do with endurance athletes, triathletes in particular, is from an iron perspective. I think a lot of people don't realize the impact of iron, or they don't have their iron levels measured, and it makes a huge difference in performance and health. From an ergogenic standpoint, that's where it gets a little tricky, because we know ergogenically, probably one of the most popular ergogenic aids as far as supplements is creatine, right? It's got thousands of published research articles that we know hands down it works for strength and power athletes. It's still, to be determined with endurance athletes based on your goals. If you're in a resistance training hypertrophy state, you want to add some lean mass, absolutely go for it. But I think there's a few in particular from an ergogenic standpoint that I think a lot of triathletes should start either reading on or learning more about. And those certainly can include sodium citrate, and that's just a buffering compound. You may have heard of it from the term or the other classification, sodium bicarbonate. And that's simply the little orange box that some of us have in our refrigerator. That's just the Arm & Hammer. That's pure buffering. We're trying to buffer a lot of the lactic acid that we have built up during exercise. Now, fortunately or unfortunately, sodium bicarbonate usually produces some pretty serious GI distress. The way I've heard it in some of my athletes is explosive diarrhea. So might not be the best thing to take. we've found and we've shown that sodium citrate is a lot easier on the stomach, and it still works to buffer. Now, it's funny because, the whole story behind sodium citrate is that you're trying to buffer really hard intensity efforts. So, a lot of endurance athletes looked at it like, well, why do I need this? Well, if you're going through a power improving phase, or really a strength building phase, where you're doing up to 30-second efforts, really tough on the bike, the swim, or the run, then sodium citrate could actually help produce positive physiological adaptation. If you're just doing long, slow distance stuff, it doesn't make sense to take it. So why even, you know, blink an eye with it? So sodium citrate, definitely. I think, again, I don't think a lot of athletes, triathletes, recognize that carbohydrates and fluid can actually be an ergogenic aid. It does, you know, ergogenic means performance enhancing, and we know that fluid and carbohydrates do that. I think out on the horizon, and it's been on the horizon for about 4 or 5 years, but it's really, there's a lot more companies popping up that are doing this, but these compounds called adaptogens are becoming very popular, and they're basically herbal supplements that counteract the stress response in the body. So it helps our body respond to stress, and, you know, that not only the daily stress, but the stress of our workouts that we're doing every single day. So I think we're going to continue to see quite a bit of supplements with adaptogens, and there are hundreds of adaptogens. Probably the most popular in supplements right now are called Rhodiola rosea and Cordyceps. So those are two you'll see in some supplements, but it could have an ergogenic effect, absolutely. So I think hands down, I'm not a big pill pusher, but hands down, we need supplements. You know, as far as classifying in those three areas, we absolutely hands down need supplements. It just depends on which area you're talking about. I should also mention, while I'm on that subject, I'm a huge fan of omega-3 supplementation because of the anti-inflammatory responses that we're seeing with omega-3 supplementation and the body's responses. And we know as we exercise, we actually induce inflammation in our body, and one of the best ways from a nutrition standpoint is to balance out our omega-3 and our omega-6 levels. And the best way, you know, one of the best ways to do that is, you know, we can certainly eat fish and, you know, high omega-3 foods, but there aren't that many that can actually give us the benefits that supplementing with fish oil can. So I think that's why we're seeing a lot of athletes supplement with fish oil these days, and it's absolutely justified. It's been proven in research to work on cardiovascular patients, so reducing the inflammation in the body there. And there's some research beginning to surface now on omega-3 supplementation to reduce inflammation in athletes. So I would definitely keep that one on the horizon, but I recommend quite a few of our elite triathletes are on that right now. And, of course, when it comes to supplementation, I have to say this, depending on what level you're racing at, really need to make sure where you're sourcing it from, because there's a lot of scares and a lot of issues with supplement contamination these days. So, you know, part of my job too, and it certainly can be part of yours if you're thinking about taking a supplement, is to call the manufacturer and simply ask for their quality control procedures, their manufacturing procedures, if they can share that with you, if they can produce what's called a certificate of analysis at the very least. And, you know, if they can and if they do, they'll have third-party clinical testing to make sure that what's in their supplement is actually in it and there's nothing that's contaminated, no contaminated substances in there. And we see athletes getting dinged for that every year where they say, you know, I'm taking an electrolyte supplement and, you know, how did I test positive for a precursor to steroids? So it's something to be said. Really watch out especially for the elites out there. If you get drug tested, really pay attention to that. And even for us age groupers, I think it's still important to know what's in the supplement so, you know, we don't have any adverse effects of possible, you know, supplement contamination or if you're on medications, possible medication interactions with these supplements.
Yeah. In particular, so basically look for a third party source to confirm that it's okay to take those supplements from that company. Is that the main thing? Or
that's the big thing. And, you know, a lot of, you know, some two particular companies, the NSF, if you see like an NSF stamp on it, or an Informed Choice, those are probably two of the most popular companies that are doing testing on supplements now. I have to say that a lot of supplement companies don't do this because it costs a lot of money to batch test their products. So what I really respect is when I see supplement companies stepping up to the plate and paying for this, because that tells me that they're serious about it, they're serious about safety, and they're going to put their money where their mouth is and prove it to us. So absolutely, hands down, look for those types of companies and you know, give them your business.
Awesome, awesome. Great piece of advice there. Another question we got here is basically, you hear some people say that really, you know, in terms of race nutrition, the best thing is to take in real food in terms of, you know, you've heard baked potatoes, and, you know, I've even seen some ultra-endurance guys, you know, doing 100-hour bike rides or whatever, and they're taking in, you know, mashed potatoes and chicken and things like that. So what's your take on that for triathletes, you know, taking in real food versus the supplementation food out there?
Yeah, I think there's some interesting answers to that. And I think first and foremost, again, I think define your distance, because if you're doing anything less than an Ironman, it's going to be pretty hard to digest solid food. If you're in fact racing it, and you're not going to be out there for a long time at lower intensity. So just going back to the higher intensity equals lower digestive abilities. You know, Ironman athletes, I think you could get by with some solid foods, but again, you don't want to. I usually am not a big fan of even Ironman athletes trying to do a lot of solid foods because of that possible GI distress, just because there's not adequate blood flow to the gut to help break it down. Now, certainly there's, you know, that 5% outside the bell-shaped curve, and those are, you know, we don't want to call them freaks in nature, but sometimes they are. But, you know, I think it's take into consideration that they're also doing that in training. So they're teaching their body how to process that food during those conditions. So, you know, Kerry, like you were saying, I think the ultra guys and gals out there with the 100-mile-plus, I think it's so easy to eat solid food because, you know, usually unless you're climbing a, you know, 10,000-foot mountain pass, usually your intensity is pretty low. But for triathlon, the first side of the sword is if you can teach your body how to do it in training, then fantastic. The second side is that it could be beneficial if you do teach your body because, again, a lot of the things I'm seeing come across you know, my desk and my email, my telephone, are GI distress. And what I'm seeing is a lot of what I call gut rot out there. So you introduce a lot of simple sugars in the form of, you know, high sugar gels, high sugar drinks, at a certain point throughout the race, and it might not bite you until after the race, of which I hear most of the athletes when they feel lethargic or they're vomiting. If it bites you after the race, great. But if it bites you during, that gut rot could take you out of a race. So that could give you good evidence and good support of saying, you know, maybe I should go easy on the gels. You know, maybe I should sneak in, you know, half a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, or just a honey sandwich, or something that your body can process. So, I think it's a very good point. As long as your body can train itself to do it, I just haven't met many Ironman or 70.3 or sprint or Olympic triathletes who can actually pull it off successfully while racing at a high intensity. It's a great idea, though. I wish our bodies were a little bit smarter in processing it, but I just, you know, try it in training. It's a valid concept. I would actually support it fully if we could, especially in long course racing.
Yeah. You think even with fruit juice, it's tough for people to do?
I'm sorry? Say that one more time.
Even with something such as fruit juice, it's tough to do?
I think fruit juice, yeah, just because, you know, fruit juice is tough because, number one, you need to spike it with a lot of sodium because it usually has very low sodium. But because it has a little more more fructose in it at times, that could be a little bit tougher on the gut depending on the ratio and the quantity. You know, we can increase our carbohydrate absorption by using a little bit of fructose. But, you know, fruit juice itself, I think is, you know, that sweet factor, and I hear this from athletes too, is they just want to get away from the sweets. And we know, you know, it's scientifically proven, the longer we exercise, the less affinity for sweet foods we have, meaning we don't want a lot of sweets. So I'm seeing some products come out there that are either dosed lower on the sweetness factor or a little more tart, which I'm actually supporting. You know, on that topic, Kerry, a lot of athletes will dilute their sport drinks because of this. And you know, I think that's fine from a carbohydrate perspective, but just remember that when you're diluting your sport drink, you're also diluting your electrolytes, which is diluting your plasma or your sodium content in your blood, which may predispose you for hyponatremia. So, again, and I've got a lot of elites who I work with on the ITU circuit who will – they'll dilute their sport drink, but I have concentrated a little bit more with some electrolyte tablets just to make sure I get that balance right.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. We got a few people on the webcast who are asking a few questions. You want to answer them?
I'd love to.
All right, awesome. We got Peter, and Peter's asking, this is kind of actually what we were talking about a little bit ago. Is there a natural way to consume sufficient nutrients during a half Ironman, i.e. something that does not involve drinking, eating fructose, maltodextrin, laden bars, or drinks?
Wow, so you're talking real food.
Yeah, basically.
Let me think about that real quick. The first response I would have is it depends on the intensity that you're doing. So, again, if you're racing a half, is it possible? Absolutely. I think anything is possible. I think you can train your body to do that, even if it's something as simple, and I don't know if this fits your qualification, but even if it's something as simple as white bread, white bread and jam, I think, that can still sustain the carbohydrate needs without getting a lot of these formulated sugar compounds in. As long as you train the gut, I've had some athletes do like fruit bars and stuff, those fruit, kind of like fruit roll-ups, but they're actual, like fruit leathers is what they're called. I've had a lot of athletes, but train their bodies in during their training. But again, the golden nugget here is just remember when you're doing this in training, you've got to do what I call race simulation nutrition training. So pick your pace, be it a heart rate, pace, or power zone. Take about an hour to 2 hours of a training session or a combo workout. Simulate your race intensity. Then try these types of things, your white bread and your jam or your fruit leather, to see what kind of response it's going to have on your body. Chances are if it has a good response, you're good to go through the half Ironman. But keep on trying it. But I would say absolutely. I mean, there's a lot we can actually learn from the ultra running and ultra cycling world. And I think, these guys and gals, every day they train their bodies to do the solid foods, and there I see a lot of triathletes entering in the, it's kind of a funny aside, but a lot of triathletes entering the ultra endurance markets in competitions. And, they try and sustain themselves on all these supplement products like the bars, gels, and drinks. And they end up bonking or they end up vomiting because, during that you need solid food or you need real food. However, I think what they forget is these ultra athletes are doing it and simulating it during their training. So that's a very long answer to say yes.
All right, good deal. Good deal. Ted from Toronto asks, what is your recommendation as protein sources for a triathlete with lactose intolerance training for an Ironman?
Yeah, I think if that question is more on the daily side of things, kind of depends. I see a lot of athletes with lactose intolerance, and there are definitely different grades of lactose intolerance. If you're pretty lactose intolerant, pretty severe, you can certainly get by with lactose free products, and they make them. They're bountiful, at least in the States with the milks and whatnot. They make the enzyme tablets, so it helps you break down lactose. But to be honest, I have a lot of my athletes who do have lactose intolerance. We just dose lactose-containing foods in very small doses and more frequently throughout the day, because that usually doesn't provide that response to the body, be it bloating or nausea, vomiting, or diarrhea. So my first answer would be, if it's not too serious, shrink down your lactose products and include them with other foods, so it kind of works for on that positive digestion. And then secondly, if it's really, really, really bad, just stay away from the products, buy the products that are lactose-free.
Awesome. All right, good deal.
And even from that standpoint, a lot of the whey protein powders out there, and I consult a lot of athletes on whey protein, whey protein isolate is pretty darn low in lactose. So, again, in small amounts, you can still consume pretty high-quality protein sources.
Okay, good. All right, Jonathan from Buffalo, New York asks, how about caffeine? How much should you have?
I can't believe I failed to mention caffeine. Caffeine is one of my favorite ergogenic aids in the world.
I thought you were going to mention it too, man.
Yeah, that's a great thank you for bringing that question up. I don't know why my mind flipped that. That's probably the most popular supplement protocol I work with triathletes, and you name the endurance athlete, is caffeine protocol. We know it works. However, what we don't know is how each athlete's body responds to it. So, again, kind of the whole tried in training first. The dosage that is recommended is based on body weight, and that dose is 3 to 9 milligrams of caffeine per kilogram of body weight. So what I recommend athletes do is always dose lower on the beginning, just to see what kind of response your body is going to get, because too much can cause some gastric distress, some GI distress. So go low, and what's usually recommended is about 60 to 90 minutes before the training session or before the race, you start dosing. Now, keep in mind that caffeine has a half-life of about 4 to 6 hours. So if you're using it for a race, just keep in mind the distance of your race. Obviously, I don't have a lot of athletes starting caffeine too early. You know, they'll dose beforehand, and then maybe somewhere on the bike, you know, if it's a half or if it's a full Ironman, somewhere on the bike they'll start again. And I usually recommend a lower end, about maybe 3 milligrams, maybe 4 milligrams, if the gut can take it, about every 60 to 90 minutes once you introduce it again during exercise. And that's, you know, we usually see Coke at aid stations on the run. And, you know, the good factor to keep in mind is once you start, don't stop. But hands down, caffeine works. It's just a matter of dosing, because some athletes need more and some athletes need less, especially if you're what I call a habitual caffeine user. If you consume a lot of caffeine during the day, you may not have as much of a response as someone who doesn't produce caffeine. But the whole basis, just to dispel this myth out there, the whole basis that we've been finding, at least in research, where what caffeine really does for us is it acts as a central nervous system stimulant. The whole theory of improving free fatty acid utilization and using more fat, that's pretty much thrown out the door now. It stimulates our central nervous system. It keeps us more mentally acute and able to focus better, and actually decreases our rating of perceived exertion. So I highly, highly recommend it. But, again, try it in training and dose it lower to higher during quality training sessions.
Okay, so it does nothing in terms of glycogen stores burning better or anything like that?
There's, I think, one study out there that shows that, but I think it's really interesting data in showing that it can actually improve carbohydrate oxidation. But
yeah,
it's one study. I wouldn't use that as the primary focus of using caffeine. I would use the central nervous system first before more research can actually tell us, oh, yeah, that works or it doesn't work.
Okay. All right. Excellent. And he also asks, can you have too much of it?
Absolutely. I think a lot of us make mistakes during our training, and unfortunately, I think I made that mistake years ago, and it will cause some pretty serious GI distress if you overdose, which is why I recommend going lower to start with and then seeing where your body's threshold is. And you'll know it right away, because you'll lose that mental acuity, you'll lose that focus without a lot of GI distress, and that's kind of your cusp of almost where you want to be. If you feel GI distress, specifically what I've seen a lot is with diarrhea or runny stool, I would definitely dose down immediately.
Okay, good deal. Actually, Julie from Littleton wants to know, she wants you to repeat your website for your book and all that stuff. Can you repeat that for the Fuel Formers website?
I will, yep. So you can find great sport nutrition information in my book for sale on my Fuelformance website, and that's www.feul4mance.com, Fuelformance.com, or you can find my book on Amazon anywhere.
Good deal. And
I'm sorry. I keep on misspelling my website, don't I? You guys are picking that up? Fuel as in guest, F-U-E. Sorry about that.
I'll tell you what, I'll shoot your website out to everyone tomorrow in the email,
it.
So we'll get that covered for everyone.
No problem.
All right. Jane from Indiana asks, how much fish oil per day and what brands are safe with no mercury contamination?
Yep. Great questions. I think, with that, there's never an easy answer. I will recommend one particular company just because years ago, one of our elite females came to me and said, this company approached me. They want me to start using their product. What do you think? And what I did was call the company and actually educated them quite a bit on some third-party testing. They had no idea that one, that existed, and two, that they should do it. So what happened, and, you know, I didn't hear from them for about 6 months, and they called me up and they said, okay, we got the third-party testing. Will you look at our supplement now? And I said, oh, that's fantastic. They showed me the quality, the certificate of analysis. They showed me the third-party testing. So I would highly recommend Zone Labs, Z-O-N-E, Labs. Mm-hmm. And I think you can find them at zoneliving.com. That's the, if you guys have ever heard of the Zone Diet before, it's the maker of the Zone Diet, Dr. Barry Sears, has come up with these great omega-3s. They're putting a lot of money into their testing, which I completely support. As far as dosing is concerned, depends on your physical goals that you want to attain. So, for example, for anti-inflammation purposes, what we've seen in the research for cardiovascular disease is about 2 to 4 grams a day. For sports, while I haven't seen it in a published, this has been on, you know, triathletes or endurance athletes, we usually tend to dose up, and I've heard, and this is purely anecdotal, and I need to let everybody know that about 5 to 10 grams a day. So if you want to be safe, I would dose about 4 grams a day. You can certainly experiment, but again, if you're taking any medications, talk to your physician to see if there's an interaction between fish oil and your medications.
Good deal. And can you just tell us the third-party resources again for testing that you recommend?
Yep. One is N as in Nancy, S as in Sam, F as in Frank, NSF, and then Informed Choice.
Okay.
So those are two big ones around there. They're really that's their business is to test, and especially Informed Choice. They're really working hard at getting a lot of supplements tested these days.
Good deal. And do you have any supplements in particular that you recommend that you think are solid?
I think as far as the Zone is concerned, any of their omega-3s are pretty good. You know, they've got different dosages of their omega-3s. So they've got, you know, one pretty super high dose, which they recommend to, you know, professional athletes. But, you know, anyone who's really going under a high stress load or a high inflammatory load. But I think any of their omega-3 supplements are fantastic. You know, I think if you're looking for a solid multivitamin that actually has iron, and again, I hit on iron a little bit earlier, and I'm such a fan of iron. I'm so particular and methodical with iron nowadays that we've been using, and I've again been in this field for a little while, and I've recently in the past few years switched the source of iron that I've used with athletes, and it's really important for those of you who are taking iron right now or thinking about it, is stop taking what's called ferrous sulfate and start taking what's called ferrous bisglycinate. It's also called ferrochel. So that is about 75% more absorbed or better absorbed than ferrous sulfate. There's nothing wrong with ferrous sulfate except you don't absorb a lot of it. So one supplement on the market right now that combines a multivitamin and this iron in it is called the Multi-V from First Endurance. Highly, highly recommend it. In fact, I've done some blood work testing with some athletes that I coach, and when I pretty much break them down with probably the highest training load that you can imagine, high volume, high intensity, and we've measured blood work, while taking this multivitamin, their iron stores have actually increased, which I've never seen before in my life.
Oh, wow.
It's something to be said about it's just this different iron source that's better absorbed. And keep in mind, too, if you're taking iron supplementation, just to get on this soapbox real quick, you know, in the past we've had to superdose iron because we knew that types like ferrous sulfate are so low in absorption that we need to superdose it. Well, what we haven't realized is that as you increase the dose of iron, the absorption rate actually goes down. So with this new type of iron, this ferrochel, or a.k.a. ferrous bisglycinate, you only have to dose what the recommended daily allowance is, which is fantastic. So there's no concern of hemochromatosis, the iron overload disease, or overloading with iron.
Good deal. Good deal. Yeah. Actually, Ted from San Francisco was asking a question on any recommended iron intake, and he basically answered that, and he says, I like to use raisins.
Thought on that? Yeah, absolutely. As a whole, I think there are some great foods, you know, blackstrap molasses, raisins, you know, lean red meat. I mean, obviously, you don't want to do that during training or racing. But, you know, there's some great food sources. But even in our westernized diet, if you're a non-vegetarian, you're only going to absorb about 18% of that iron. if you're a vegetarian in our society, you'll absorb about 10% of the iron. So these foods, they're fantastic ways to get iron. Unless you're already iron deficient or anemic, then you cannot get out of that hole with just food alone. That's where the supplement comes in handy to kind of get you over the hump and then start being aggressive with those foods again. But absolutely, hands down, you can use those types of foods.
All right. And then Heidi Fleming from Port Orange, Florida, wants to know if you have any thoughts on Juice Plus.
Juice Plus. Yeah, I think, you know, the concept is I understand the concept. What I see a lot of times is, you know, I'll include that in the supplement category. I think athletes are taking supplements, especially things like Juice Plus, which is just basically your concentrated fruits and vegetables. They're taking them for the wrong reasons, and those reasons are usually, well, I don't consume those in my diet, therefore I can take a pill and get all my recommended allowances. So, you know, there's a lot. It's not just Juice Plus. There are others on the market too, so I'm not picking on Juice Plus. But I think the concept is just, I just believe that athletes aren't using it properly, or they're justifying it in the wrong manner in trying to take it.
Gotcha.
Yep. So, again, you know, can we get all the nutrients we need from our diet alone, from foods alone? You know, depending on your training cycle, I'd probably say no. But again, that's why we look at multivitamins, we look at iron, we look at calcium, we look at these kind of things, we look at fish oils, because sometimes we can't eat enough. Or, you know, you can get in a whole argument about the bioavailability, but, you know, I think there are places for these supplements at the right time, and that includes the sports supplements, the drinks, the bars, and the gels also.
Good deal.
Yep.
And that's all we got, Bob. So what's the name of your book again? And they can get that on Amazon, right?
Yep. The book is Nutrition Periodization for Endurance Athletes, kind of specific to us. You know, I wrote it as a triathlete and as a sport dietitian. You can get it on Amazon. You can go to my website, of which I will spell correctly this time. It's FUEL4MANCE. So fuel, like the fuel you put in your car, 4, and then MANCE. So fantastic.
Good deal. And Bob, I'll shoot that out to everyone, and everyone on the call, I'll shoot his website out to you tomorrow for sure. And Bob, thanks so much for coming on to the call with us.
Oh, I appreciate it. And Terry, just, you know, thank you, because you know the service you're providing athletes is phenomenal with all this education. So I think everyone should do the virtual clap for Kerry, because he definitely needs some appreciation going his way also.
Thank you very much, Bob.
You're welcome.
All right, and that's it, and we'll talk to you later.
All right, sounds good. Thanks, everybody.
All right, bye-bye. Everyone, bye. Have a good night, and we'll see you at the same time, same place next week. Bye-bye.